Sawate discipuli and sawate omnes. Welcome again to another episode of Latin in Layman's, where it's going to be story time. So sit back, relax, pop open, I don't know, a bubbly, have some tea, have some coffee. I myself am double fisting some water and some tea right now. So, featuring that nice little throat clearing, let's get on into it. With that being said, with all of that having been outlined, the myth that we're going to get into today is Eros and Psyche. I wrote a little story to go alongside here, so this is all coming from me and my noggin. And what we're going to do is we're going to talk about this myth. We're going to talk about the story itself. And then we're going to evaluate it a little bit, kind of dive deeper into it, understand the etiological meanings behind this myth. Are there things embedded? Are there things that we can extrapolate and put in or really take into our own life? We can take bits and pieces from these myths, kind of like trimming of a tree, as you will, where maybe certain things you agree with and you can take that snippy, snippy, snip, throw it into your own ideologies, your beliefs, the way you conduct yourself in your life, or maybe you're a little different, you know? Maybe you do things a little differently. I don't know. You're your own person. You're your own individual. You are the master of your own universe. The universe that you call your video game or whatever you want to do. I always tie it to video games for my students. Gamify it a little bit. They really enjoy it. I think that they're, and sometimes they give me great ideas too, like they call my propagations and all the propagations that we're doing, they call it an infinite plant glitch. And I think that that's a great way to put it, at least for little kids to kind of understand it a little bit better, because that's what it is really. You just clip a little bit off of the, you know, Big Bertha here, throw her in some water, let that little cutting root, plant it in some soil. Skibbity-bibbity-bob, there you go with a whole new plant that'll start to grow and create its own little Berthas, little BB Berthas. So, one other thing that I did want to address is I was reading some comments about myths in the past, and one of our supporters here, Aya, or Aya, however that is stressed and or pronounced, apologies. Go ahead and correct me, wherever you can. But, she mentioned something about Icarus and all of these, you know, myths, and, they really tie back to hubris, and hubris is really challenging the nature of the gods, really. But also hubris can really be challenging the nature of, you know, humility, essentially. Because I'm going to go ahead and pull it up here. I'm going to have to do it on my phone because oddly enough, Spotify for Podcasters has been really walk-a-donkey here on the whole old desktop version. But if you do it on the actual, let's see if I can find it here real quickly. It's showing up really well on the mobile version, but not particularly on the desktop version. So bear with me while I go ahead and find this comment here real quickly. So I can't find it. I don't know why. That's why I'm really frustrated with Spotify for Podcasters right now. I think I'm looking to shift over to another platform here because it's just like it shows that I have Q&A responses and then I open it up and then arm and a leg trying to find it because one link opens up to another link to another window to another window, and it's just really obnoxious. Anyways, I was it was really in defense of Icarus, and you know, maybe Icarus was actually just, you know, not really being or practicing hubris, but really just, you know, being beckoned to his own calling, really. I can't remember exactly. You worded it differently. I apologize. But I see where you come from with that, but I thought that that was interesting. I wanted to touch upon it really quickly because Icarus wasn't it was he wasn't really challenging. Well, yes, he was in a way, and I don't think it's wrong to challenge the nature of the gods sometimes in this respect, but he also was just naive, if you really think about it. I mean, he was told one thing, and also about the myth of Icarus and Daedalus is that Daedalus was the expert. He was the guy that knew. He was the guy that created the labyrinth. He was the guy that concocted this plan, as well as gathering up the feathers, the wax, and all that stuff. Sometimes we have things in place and parameters in place that we need to follow in order to respect something that we may not yet understand fully and completely. When you don't understand something fully and completely, you shouldn't really dive into it full guns blazing, balls to the wall, or else you go in uninformed. You have to be more informed. And Icarus was a little uninformed. And that's why Daedalus stressed to him. He was like, dude, you gotta, like, as my son, please, for me, so that you live, because I love you. Don't fly too close to the water. Don't fly too close to the sky. Just listen to me. And sometimes it is about listening. It's not about always being anarchistic. I see where you come from, and I've seen your comments before. I understand where you come from, but you also have to not always be at arms. Sometimes you have to respect what it is and what other people have to say, because you're not always right. I'm not always right. Icarus ain't always right. Daedalus isn't always right. But at the end of the day, the hubris about it wasn't that Icarus was trying to challenge the nature of the gods. He just was naive, and he didn't understand that. Well, he did, really. But the fact was is that he just didn't listen to his dad, whom his dad loved him so much. And yet, at the end of the day, I don't know. But hubris is also challenging, and thinking that you're better, all right, than what others have to say, and not taking into account other opinions, other knowledges, other ideologies, to at least think about. And I just want to address this because, quite frankly, I do think you're wrong in that respect. I think that Icarus really was naive, and that there was a lot that he could have really soaked up that he just didn't, because he wanted to do his own thing. And sometimes that's the rebellion of being a youth and a teenager and an adolescent. But then again, that's where it always comes to be. Consequences. Con meaning together and or with. Sequence coming from the Latin sequor, which means what follows, right? That's where we get sequence. So consequences are what follows with the actions that we take. So we always have to think about the actions that we take and the consequences that ensue thereafter. The consequences that not only are our own, but the consequences that leave collateral damage. What about Daedalus outliving his son? Parents outliving their kids, it sucks. I've seen it before. The way that they deal with it, depression. It's awful. So, I don't know. Sometimes I think that it's right to check yourself. I don't think it's always okay to think that you are the creme de la creme. And that whatever stirs in you a passion is something that you should follow. Sometimes, maybe not. Maybe you got to think about it a little bit. Check yourself. Check the people around you, or those people can check you as well. But unfortunately, Icarus didn't have many people to check other than himself. But unfortunately, he had a little bit too much that he was thinking about in his own head to where he kind of negated anything and everything that his dad had said. I don't know. I think that I would be too worried. if I was flying, I would just want to get home. I would just want to be safe on land, away from the Minotaur, away from King Minos, and finally, you know, be back in Athens or something. And then you can do your adolescent stuff there. I think that there is just too much at stake. But anyways, I wanted to address that because I thought that that was an interesting concept, but something that I don't really agree with, but I do want to talk about because you don't always have to agree with things. You don't have to agree with me. I don't have to agree with you. That's the beauty of having our own brains and minds and opinions and being able to take things, like I said, trimming. And that's what these myths are. You trim from it what you gather and what serves you, and then leave the rest aside. It's all good. I think you'll be okay. I'll be okay. I think we'll all be okay. So with all that being said, let's get on into this episode. And it's just going to be a little bit of a story. So time to kick back, relax, and let's do this. In the time when gods and goddesses walked the celestial realms, and mortals marveled at their divine presence, there existed a tale that transcended the boundaries between the ethereal and the earthly, a narrative woven with the threads of love and envy and the trials of the human soul. This here is the myth of Eros and Psyche, an allegory that delves into the intricacies of love, the fragility of trust, and the enduring strength of the human spirit. Once upon a time, in a long, 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 long time ago, way off in a faraway land, in the opulent city of a mortal king, there lived a woman of unparalleled beauty named Psyche. Her radiance surpassed that of the goddess Aphrodite herself, stirring the envy and the ire of the divine mistress of love and beauty. The citizens of the kingdom, captivated by Psyche's allure, began to neglect the worship of Aphrodite, whose temple stood abandoned as the people's adoration shifted towards the mortal maiden. Unable to tolerate this affront to her divine ego, Aphrodite concocted a plan to humble the mortal who dared eclipse her glory. Sounds like hubris. She summoned her son, Eros, the mischievous god of love, and bade him to unleash an arrow of irresistible desire into Psyche's heart, causing her to fall in love with a creature so wretched and vile that her beauty would be squandered on an unworthy match. However, as Eros took aim with his enchanted arrow, he beheld Psyche's radiant countenance and he himself ensnared, entangled, and trapped by the potent magic. Struck by his own creation, Eros found himself madly in love with the mortal beauty he was supposed to condemn. Succumbing to a forbidden passion, he concealed his true identity from Psyche, visiting her only in the shadowy veil of night. Psyche, blissfully unaware of her divine suitor, lamented her loneliness, longing for a true love that would fill her days with joy and companionship. Rumors of her unearthly beauty reached far and wide, and suitors from distant lands sought her hand, only to be turned away by the king, who feared offending the gods and goddesses. We gotta show love to the girls as well, even though these myths don't really show love to them. As the years passed, Psyche's solitude grew, and her kingdom fell into despair. Desperate to appease the gods and secure a worthy match for his daughter, the king consulted an oracle, seeking guidance on how to appease the divine wrath that loomed over his kingdom. the oracle, attuned to the cosmic currents, revealed a dire prophecy. Psyche was destined to marry a monster so terrifying that even the bravest of men would cower at the sight. The king, burdened by the weight of destiny, resigned himself to the inevitable and made the somber announcement that Psyche would be wedded to a monstrous suitor. Heartbroken and resigned to her fate, Psyche awaited the arrival of her hideous husband, prepared to face the monstrous creature that the gods decreed her to be as the spouse. Sorry, that's a little bit of a typo on my end. Yet, as the fateful day approached, a gentle breeze lifted her from her mortal abode and carried her to a palace of exquisite splendor, where she found herself surrounded by unseen attendants and sumptuous luxuries. In this enchanted palace, Psyche lived in blissful ignorance of her surroundings, her every need attended to by invisible hands. Night after night, her mysterious husband visited her, their encounters shrouded in darkness, veiling the identity of the one who shared her bed. Psyche, entranced by the tenderness of her unseen lover, began to doubt the ominous prophecy that had foretold her the union with a monster. Unable to contain her curiosity, Psyche sought to unravel the mystery of her husband's identity. Under the cover of darkness, she lit a lamp, revealing the divine countenance of Eros, the god of love. Struck by the revelation, Psyche trembled with a mixture of awe and fear, for she had broken the trust of her immortal lover. Eros, wounded by her betrayal, fled from the palace, leaving Psyche bereft of her divine presence. The once glorious palace crumbled into ruin, and Psyche found herself alone in the desolate wilderness. Determined to win back the love she had lost, Psyche embarked on a perilous journey to seek the counsel of Aphrodite herself. Aphrodite, still harboring resentment, because that's just what gods do, they're just resentful and petty, for the mortal who had threatened her supremacy, devised a series of seemingly insurmountable tasks to test Psyche's devotion and worthiness. Each task posed a greater challenge than the last, demanding feats of courage, resilience, and unwavering faith. Psyche, driven by her love for Eros, faced these trials with unyielding determination. She gathered the golden fleece of rams that grazed on the edge of the world, collected the water of the river Styx, and descended into the depths of the underworld to procure a box containing the beauty of Persephone herself. Through the course of her trials, Psyche's mortal nature was tempted by the fires of adversity, and she emerged not only as a paragon of beauty, but also as a symbol of strength and wisdom and enduring love. And as she completed the final task and presented the box to Aphrodite, the goddess, begrudgingly conceded the magnitude of Psyche's love. Meanwhile, Eros, unable to resist the pull of his heart, sought Psyche in the depths of the mortal realm. Witnessing her unwavering devotion and triumphant completion of the seemingly impossible tasks, he cast aside his wounded pride and reunited with his beloved. The gods, moved by the mortal's perseverance and the divine love that transcended all trials, bestowed immortality upon Psyche, elevating her to the status of a goddess. As such, the myth of Eros and Psyche, etched into the annals of Greek mythology. resonates with the timeless themes that transcend the boundaries of culture and time and love and temptation and all these things, really. And at its core, the tale explores the transformative power of love. Of love. The trials, the tests of the strength of the human spirit and the eternal dance between mortality and divinity. At least in my opinion. But also, one cannot help but be captivated by this radiant beauty of Psyche, who was this mortal whose allure challenged the very gods, the very nature of gods themselves. That's where the hubris comes from, right? Her journey from the heights of the mortal splendor to the depths of the divine trials mirrors the human experience, a voyage through joy and sorrow, triumph and tribulation. It kind of serves as a poignant reminder that love through the boundless and eternal is not really exempt from the trials that beset mortal existence. I love that point. I thought about this. So many people are so non-committal nowadays. And you know what? That's the one thing that I think about when I was doing a lot of physical therapy assistance and working with the quote-unquote advanced populations, aka the older populations. I always loved talking with them and asking them questions. And whenever I asked them questions about the love that they had had between their partner for 60 years, 70 years, forever, however long that it was, I was like, how did you do that, man? I'm like, dude, I've been in relationships for like 4 years at a time, and I'm like, God, and it ended, and it wasn't the right love. I'm like, how do you do that? Because like I've had relationships that want to fix that relationships by bringing other people into the relationship or going polyamorous or, you know, all these things that show non-commitment in this world. And I know that I get actually a lot of people mad when I talk about this. Sometimes I'll get into just like these random conversations with people when I'm doing work at a coffee shop. And sometimes, you know, people just want to talk. And sometimes people just like approaching me, asking me a question. Sometimes I strike up a conversation by complimenting a person on, you know, something that they've put effort into for that day. A lot of the time, I really notice cool pants. Cool shoes and boots too. Sometimes if it's a wacky shirt, and if I compliment them sometimes like that, then it opens up a conversation. And I have found myself often caught in the middle of being told that I'm a boomer as a 28-year-old because I just can't really get behind the whole polyamory thing. And I'm not a boomer. First off, stop throwing that slide at me, because I really dislike the boomers because they need to step aside and stop being greedy and buying up all the property and turning them into Airbnbs and jacking up all the prices on everything and making it so that we live in a world where I'll never be able to put a down payment on a freaking house, and we're all going to be nomads and digital nomads or whatever we're going to be doing, when the American dream is no longer the American dream. So don't call me a boomer, because I am not a boomer and I do not like boomers. I'm an old soul. That's what I've been told. Is it so hard to think that it's impossible to find the partner of your life, you know, your partner in crime, to find that person? My parents have been married. It'll be 29 or 30 years. I think it's 30 years come December 29th this year. December 30th, I apologize. I've seen them go through it, but I've also seen them love, like really love deeply and profoundly. And I give myself goosebumps when I say that, because I've seen what love is, and I know what love, true love is, because true love is an action. Remember, in Latin, we have the noun form, amor, amoris. It's a third declension Latin noun. But we also have the action, the first conjugation verb, amo amare, that we learn at the very beginning, amo amas amat, amamas amatis amat, that can be iterated in so many different tenses the past, the imperfect, the pluperfect, the future perfect, the present passive participial, the supine, the gerundive. It's ever changing. Love is an action, and it requires to be evaluated constantly, at least in my opinion. The character of Eros, the god of love, embodies the complexities of desire and really this unpredictable nature of affection. Is enchanting Eros capable of kindling passion or breeding disdain? Underscore the capriciousness of love and the unforeseen consequences that arise when emotions are manipulated. Through Eros, the myth delves into the labyrinth corridors of the heart, exploring the transformative power of love and the inherent vulnerability that it accompanies, or that accompanies it. To be in love is to be very vulnerable. You flay yourself open. You guys know this. That's why love hurts so much when love is lost. Heartbreak hurts because you have fleshed yourself out. You have flayed yourself out. You have made yourself vulnerable to this person whom, you know what, at the end of the day, you're not going to find yourself with the entirety of your life. And then you're like, damn. I spent all that time investing in that relationship, and for what? Maybe you've said that. I've said that before in my life. But then there's that wallowing, the sorrow, the like, God darn it. But also, it goes to show that cheesy quote, is it better to have loved and lost than to have never loved at all? I think I would have rather experienced the emotions and the feelings and the iterations of all of it, because at the end of the day, love is a drug. And when you fall in love, love takes over you like nothing else. And that's why all these songs are written about it. That's why all these poems are written about it. Books are written about it. Because although so much of our life is encapsulated in this term love, of which if we didn't have the word for love, how would we refer to it? Shout out language. Without love, what would we have? But also, it's so nuanced. And it's so hard. And it's so intoxicating. And it takes over you. I love love. First time I fell in love, I was writing about love. I was just looking back actually recently, just a little side tangent here, ramble bamble, of my OneDrive, my OneDrive from way, way, way back, my Connerly Plaid lad at AOL.com. And I was populating a lot over because I'm doing applications right now for some master's programs here and PhD. And they want just writing samples and stuff like that. And I was diving back into, man, like I did some amazing geochemistry lab projects, geophysics, also titration labs, all these inorganic and organic that I had. I had a lab report, one of my longest lab reports I was looking at here. It was the analysis of sediment core of a lake that had a mill that had burned about 20 miles in radius about 20 years ago. And I was taking sediment core analysis because there had been some pollution, but we were wondering if that had kind of subsided at that point. So went out to the lake, took a lot of analyses via this thing that you drop down in the water and it pulls it up through the several stratas at the very bottom levels of the lake. And then I did all these, I had to throw it through centrifuges and all that good stuff. And I've done a lot of lab work in my day, like very, very like analytical And that's just my brain. Like, I'm a very anal person. Like, I can really get nitty gritty in that kind of stuff. The problem is that I drown in my thoughts being in the lab, and I just couldn't do it. Also being in Seattle and Depression City when November rolls around, anybody up there knows, like from November all the way to like sometimes until June. And then all of a sudden, as soon as the sun starts hitting, everybody's outside, no matter what. It's just such a beautiful thing. It really goes to show the appreciation of the sunlight up there in the Northwest. But, you know, side tangent there, but I was also, you know, seeing all these writings that I had done on poetry and love, and I can start sharing those, honestly, maybe on TikTok, maybe here as well. They're kind of cheesy, man. I mean, I wrote them back in like 2015, I saw, all the way to 2017, 2018, 2019. My last really, really, really deep love, I wrote a lot of letters to and a lot of things about and whatnot. And that's just me. I'm a feelsy guy. But let's get back into evaluating this just a little bit more, because I'm just ramble bambling and I hope you guys enjoy it. Because it's just really the sussing out of this myth, really, because there's a lot of intricacies. There's a lot of talk of love in this. And remember, I also talk about how there are so many several iterations of the same myth. Maybe you've heard some different iteration of this myth. This is my own writing and reading of that. So if you agree with it, rock on. If you don't, rock on. If you only agree with some of it, rock and awesome to you. And let me go ahead and check here, because I remember I'm given certain little bits here. So I'm going to stop here because it's about to stop the recording because of the 30-minute max thing. And then we'll keep on going here. Okay. So Aphrodite, however, the goddess whose divine realm was threatened by the mortal Psyche, symbolizes really the capriciousness and at times vindictive nature of love. Her envy and subsequent machinations reveal the darker facets of the divine psyche, highlighting really the perils of hubris and the consequences of challenging natural order in Aphrodite's relentless pursuit of retribution. We glimpse to the dangers of allowing ego really to cloud reason and the folly of underestimating the resilience of the human spirit. The trials faced by Psyche serve kind of really as kind of, well, I think as a metaphor for the human condition. A journey marked by the tribulations that shape and refine the soul. Reminds me of like the hero's journey. All books really, like so many books that you read, just so many Marvel stories. Think Spider-Man. Like, think like the second movie, like Spider-Man, Spidey, his identity. And then he throws away his identity, Spider-Man, because he's like, this is not me. Rah. And then he loses himself. And then he has to go through all these trials and tribulations to regain himself and find out that where he was truly the hero that he had always been. But he had to go through this purgatory where he didn't know, and he threw himself away to find himself again. That's what the human soul is. Because her quest to reunite with Eros, though fraught with peril, becomes a testament to the indomitable nature of love and really this transformative power of perseverance if you really love that person, right? In Psyche's Odyssey, we find echoes of our own struggles, a reminder that the pursuit of love, self-discovery, and the redemption of a universal endeavor that really transcends the boundaries of time and culture. You see that I'm getting worked up about this because I love love. And you think about it, if you really know figures in life, in literature, that embody love and embody the work that it is to be in love and to act upon love and be, I struggle with this. Everybody does, but ah. The myth also confronts the themes of trust, as Psyche's betrayal of Eros's trust leads her to temporary separation from the divine realm. In this, the story imparts a valuable lesson about the fragility of trust and the consequences of succumbing to curiosity at the expense of loyalty. Sometimes you gotta do that, but sometimes if it's about and regarding the person whom you love and adore, you have to think and weigh the consequences of those actions. Con meaning together and or with, sequor to follow. Consequences are what follows with those actions that we take. And Psyche's actions, born out of a desire of certainty and understanding, kind of serve as a cautionary tale, urging us to tread carefully when tempted to unveil the mysteries that shroud matters of the heart. Sometimes we're beckoned to do so, but other times, maybe not. I don't know. What do you think? But ultimately, the union of Eros and Psyche, sanctioned by the gods themselves, transcends the mortal realm, elevating Psyche to the status of a goddess, the apotheosis. I always mispronounce that word. Apotheosis. Apotheosis, it's a literary term, symbolizes the transformative power of love. Because she did, she transcended from a mortal to a god. Apio, theo, god, osis, the condition of being made into a god, essentially, is what that really refers to etymologically. But as a literary strategy, I'm going to just go ahead and do a little bit of a copy real quickly and a paste into my almighty Google, because I don't know everything all the time. And I forget the exact definition of this. So apotheosis, I'm going to do a, there we go. Apotheosis is the highest point in the development of something, aka the culmination or climax, right? Apotheosis, also called divination or deification, is the glorification of a subject to divine levels and commonly the treatment of a human being, any other living thing, or an abstract idea in the likeness of a deity, aka making Psyche into a goddess. Apotheosis. You hear that? You hear that? I'm going to play it again for y'all. I like my voice better. I don't know. Maybe she should do the podcast for me from now on. You guys let me know. I'll get that on tap if you guys need. And then my just like it with everything is becoming AI generated. Well, just this will be AI generated. Kidding. Apotheosis. Apotheo. Gotta love me when I try to like phonetically pronounce words when I break them out etymologically to piece them back together. Sometimes, Liam, let's just defer to almighty Google. This apotheosis symbolizes that transformative power of love, suggesting that the bonds forged between mortals can echo through eternity, leaving an indelible mark on the cosmic tapestry. Kind of reminds you also of, like, you know, Theseus, Ariadne, the love. Now she's up in the heavens in the cosmos. At the end of the day, the myth of Eros and Psyche, with its rich tapestry of themes and symbolism, remains a timeless allegory that invites contemplation and introspection. It's a narrative that beckons all of us to explore the depths of our own hearts, to confront the complexities of love, and to navigate the labyrinth of the human experience with grace and resilience and an unwavering belief in the enduring power of love. I love love. I wish we all embrace love a little bit more in this world. Because as we peer into the myth's profound depths, we find not only a captivating story of gods and mortals, but also a mirror reflecting the universal truths that define this human condition. Thank you, guys. Take someone. Let them know that you love them. Be grateful. Gratitude. Gratias tibi. Thanks to you is really what that means. Gratitude to you. And gratitude to yourself, to your toes. Spread them. Try and spread them. Spread them. Lift that big toe up to the sky as high as you can right now. Try and just a big toe. Just a big toe. And if you can't, that's okay. But how complex is the human body? Just like the human mind and the soul and the spirit and everything. It's cool. And with that, I'm going to leave it there. I hope you guys have a wonderful day. Tempus est sicet erae.